Rich Kimble, Kerry Haskell here, and on the telephone line, Chad Finn of the Boston Globe, best-selling author, Man About Town, Bon Vivant. Hello there, Mr. Finn.
I'm trying to figure out how much of that's accurate, but I'm pretty good, so I guess everything's good.
I'm glad to hear that. What a weekend it was on the Boston sports scene. You know, let's put it in perspective. That's why you're here, sir. Is this Bruins collapse the worst in Boston sports history?
Well, I don't know if you looked at the Globe this morning on the website, which Shaughnessy is saying it's not the worst collapse. Our other columnist that wrote about the Bruins said it is. And then we have a gallery or a list of all the worst collapses in Boston sports. So that seems to be a theme today. I'm glad I didn't write about that. But I don't think so, because it's the first round.
Right.
I think it hurts, obviously it hurts a little bit more when you get to the Super Bowl, you're 18-0, like in 2007 Pats, and, you know, come up just a little bit short. For me personally, growing up as a Boston sports fan, I think it's still probably 86. You know, just thinking, wow, the Red Sox are finally going to win the World Series here after, how many years was it then? 68. And, you know, having what happened against the Mets. That one still hurts. I think maybe, Rich, there was a little bit of a sense of this Bruins team anyway that people weren't quite convinced they were as good as their regular season record was. So I don't think it's quite as crushing as some other things that came before, even though you woke up this morning, you're like, oh, man, that really happened.
Yeah, and I think it was kind of a double whammy for people here in Maine because of the Black Bear connection with Jimmy Montgomery and Jeremy Swayman.
Definitely, yeah. I thought Swayman was good. I mean, four goals is four goals. But, God, the defense just left him out to dry so many times. He made the save on Tkachuk in overtime on the breakaway. And would have been nice if they gave him a little bit more of a chance because given how much time he had off, I think it was 17 days other than the few minutes he played earlier in the series when Omar got kicked out. It's just a lot to ask. I thought it was the right choice to go with him, and obviously it was after we hear what Allmark's injuries were. He probably shouldn't have been in there for Game 6 either, or Game 5 or whatever. With Jimmy, it's a little harder because there's a lot of things you can second-guess. He second-guessed himself by breaking up Bergeron and Marchand in Game 5. Some of the lineup choices, putting Connor Clifton back in Game 6, oof, he's really bad. No Greslick, things like that, that are going to carry, you know, over into next season. And the interesting thing, I guess, in sort of a cynical way, but nobody's going to believe in them if they're good next year. It's going to be wait till the playoffs to see what they've really got.
All right, tonight, the Celtics, who avoided a similar fate in their opening series with the Hawks, open up against the 76ers. I feel a bit more confident knowing that it looks like Joel Embiid won't be able to go tonight.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how much is gamesmanship. My thought right now, probably not a lot of it. I know Doc Rivers is pretty straightforward with a lot of things, probably more so than a general manager would want his coach to be sometimes. And it sounds like they're really concerned about his status for the early part of the series, but beyond that as well, how effective he'll be if he does come back and play. And it presents a little bit of a different challenge for the Celtics. They were preparing, expecting a healthy Embiid. It would be pretty obvious what they need to focus on, but they kind of have to hazard a guess as to what plan B is for the Sixers and how they're going to try to attack them if he's not in the lineup. So obviously, if you're the Celtics, you feel pretty good about him not being out there, but you also can't get complacent, which is something that they have a history of doing here. So hopefully they're focused whether or not Embiid is in the lineup over the long haul in this series.
I get the feeling sometimes in watching the Celtics that particularly Brown and Tatum, if they've got a big lead, they get bored. And let's let this team back in and see if we can get it close and then win it in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, well, the data supports that. Their pace slows down in the fourth quarter. When they have a lead in a game, they just start walking the ball up the court, get kind of, it's not complacency, but kind of, just kind of passive. And I think with Jalen, he's a tremendous offensive player, tremendous scorer. But I think sometimes he gets in this mode where they're up big, where he's like, all right, time to get mine. I'm going to get some shots up now. And whereas Tatum, you know, he settles for the long threes sometimes, and the ball stalls with him a lot. But he's a little bit more willing ball mover than Brown is. But we've seen what they look like when they're playing the right way. I mean, they turned it on in the last 5 minutes in game six, and also one of the Atlanta games where they just said, all right, enough of this. They moved the ball, got good shots, knocked him down, and won the game. And that's the best version of the Celtics. And hopefully see that more in the Sixers series.
That would be good. We're talking with Chad Finn here on Downtown. The Patriots had an interesting draft, as always. Night one, everybody seemed pretty upbeat. Got a guy that they needed. Got him at a spot where people didn't think he would still be around. And then day two and three arrived, and an interesting mix. Offensive linemen, good. Very little offensive skill players, and then both a kicker and a punter.
Yeah. It's a Bill draft, right?
It is.
I felt good about it. I'm not really a draft grade guy, but Gonzalez was projected as a top 10 pick and really fits what they need in terms of a outside cornerback with some size. Just seems like they caught a really nice break there, and they played it well and picked up an extra fourth round pick to trade down. Still got a really good player. Kept going defense. I'm really interested to see you know, what they get out of this White kid who was so stone faced when they drafted him, and Maypu, who's looks like a kind of a Kyle Duggar type of player, but the very raw, played at Sacramento State. So they got speed and athleticism on defense. I like that. I like drafting the specialty guys too, a kicker and a punter. They need them both. And if they got the right ones, good. I mean, Gostkowski is a fourth round pick. I know he wasn't Vinatieri, but he was pretty good for a long time. And if you can get another guy like that and an actual punter who can punt, which they did not have last year, I don't mind spending draft picks on those. I don't mind spending the picks in the middle of the line either, because they need can only cut and bring back James Ferentz so many times. you need that depth in the middle of the line. So and I like what they did.
And Coach Belichick also appeared to acknowledge that he has met Mac Jones.
Yes, and hasn't caught him, traded him, or had him arrested, or anything they seem to want to do at the end of last season. But the more I think about this as we get further away from last year, I've never really seen a player let down by his coaching staff, at least around here, the way that he was last year. Because I just think Bill had a tremendous amount of respect for Matt Patricia. He's a really smart guy, as everybody knows, and he thought he could do the job. And it wasn't that he did the job but poorly. It was worse than that. He wasn't capable of doing it, and they had an inept offense. It was kind of a laughing stock, and it really stagnated at best their second year quarterback, that they really should have been trying to help out in any way that they could. So Mac was not on his best behavior at times last year, for sure. But I kind of empathize with what he had to deal with, and I think he's going to be a lot better this year.
Very quietly, under the radar, with the draft and then postseason runs by the Bruins and the Celtics, the Red Sox are playing, I would say, some pretty decent baseball. Tied with the Yankees. Sure, they're in fourth because Tampa Bay is playing lights out right now, but there have been some good positives for a team that hasn't been able to count on much from their starting pitching.
Yeah, it's, maybe if we talk Tuesday after Kluber faces the Blue Jays, we might have a different answer. But I think you feel pretty good about where Chris Sale is anyway. And if he can, our friend Tom Karen from Nesson, who sees the bright side on Red Sox things sometimes, tweeted yesterday that Sale's got a 3.68 ERA in his last three appearances, which, you know, is a bad one in there, but there's two pretty good ones. And if you did four, it would look a lot worse, four appearances. But there are good signs there, and I think if he can stay on the mound, which is a big question with him, obviously, he's going to be good. He's going to get gradually better as the rust wears off from just so much inactivity the last couple of years. But beyond that, I was really high on Garrett Whitlock. It's too bad he got hurt. And they're certain he's going to be a starting pitcher long term. There's no reason to talk about him as a bullpen guy anymore. But it would be nice to see him have a little bit of injury luck, because he's very talented and got off to a rough start here before the elbow started barking.
And, you know, the two catchers are both playing very well. Connor Wong showing some flash with the bat, throwing out base runners at a pretty good clip. Verdugo looks like a new man. Duran is hitting like the guy they thought he'd be. And Yoshida has come around after a rough start. But, boy, getting very little out of that first base, what's become the Red Sox Bermuda Triangle over there. Casas just can't do anything.
Yeah, he just looks like... He's a really patient hitter, and he looks like he can't decide what to swing at and what to take right now, which sometimes happens with those guys who have really good command of the strike zone, and suddenly they're in the major leagues and facing just ridiculous stuff night after night. Takes an adjustment. I think he's going to be fine, but those numbers are brutal right now. Some of the other guys, I mean, you mentioned Wong and Verdugo. Please don't tell me we're going to have to start thinking about the Mookie Betts trade in a better light, because I spent years complaining about that. Maybe they actually get some positivity out of it here. I don't quite buy it with Duran, as good as he's been. He's a guy who seems to have to change his swing every time pitchers adjust to him. So we'll see what happens when they adjust now. But obviously the tools are there, and he's a little bit more comfortable in the major leagues than he was the last couple of times he's come up. He's talked about, you know, being anxious and things like that. So maybe he's he's finding it a little bit easier than he did before. But it's not, not a bad lineup at all. Got some little weakness at the bottom, but they'll be a contender depending almost entirely on how good their pitching ends up.
Well, you know who else I think has improved and I really enjoy listening to is Kevin Youkilis.
Yeah, he seems to be the one people like the most. And you know, he's going to get the most games. He's in the 70 to 75 range this year. I think Will Middlebrooks is going to be really good.
He's I do
got
too.
A genuine sense of humor. You know, a lot of these guys, the ex-players they put in the booth, kind of force the humor a little bit. I think Youkilis does that sometimes too. But Middlebrooks is actually makes you laugh out loud once in a while. I think he'll get better and better as he gets more repetitions, but. It's not a bad cast that they have, considering, you know, what they've had to deal with in terms of changes the last couple of years, with Jerry passing away and then Eck retiring after last season. I think they've recovered fairly well and put together a pretty good crew, even though you don't really know who you're getting night to night.
Chad Finn of the Boston Globe. The book is continuing to sell like hotcakes, The Story of the Red Sox. That's something every baseball fan, every New England baseball fan ought to have. I need to get my copy to you so I can get it autographed.
No, send it down. I'll send it back. They gave me a little budget to buy some envelopes and some stamps and such. So I've been, people send it to me. I'll pay it back and they don't send it back without them having to pay the exorbitant postage fees.
You got it. I'm going to take care of that then. Chad, great to talk with you as always. Enjoy your time with the Portland crew later. Were you doing Mike's show early this morning too?
I was, man. He wakes me up in the morning. And if I go off the rails on one of these interviews someday, it's going to be that one, because the cobwebs aren't all gone in the morning yet.
Right. That's not fair. That's just way too early in the morning.
Way too early. Yeah, we'll see how long that one lasts.
Well, we thank you as always for being part of what we do. The Hall of Fame ballot, the Downtown Hall of Fame ballot, goes out tonight. Good luck to you as one of the five Boston representatives on that ballot.
Well, I'll have to round up my Morse High School class of 88 people and get some votes in on this.
There you go. Well, we wish you well in that, and we'll talk with you again soon.
All right, Rich. Take care.
Thanks, Chad. Chad Finn with us on Downtown. 12 to go before 5 o'clock. If you don't have Chad's book yet, it is so good. Seriously, every Red Sox fan should have it. It's so wonderful. It's one of those books you'll go back and revisit, I think, year after year. So get it. Get it. Maybe you can get it signed by Chad as well. Not just me. I think if you ship it off to Chad Finn, Wells, Maine, boom, we'll take care of you there.